Right. Good morning. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. I am Louise Devery Bjorkman. I'm joined on the panel this morning by Judges Sleater and Brian, and we are now ready to proceed with our second case on the calendar for oral argument. It is in the matter of the Surveillance and Integrity Review Appeal by Smart Choice Healthcare Corporation and Mohammed versus the Minnesota Department of Human Services. I know that Counsel, you are both familiar with our procedures, and they are the same, even though we are proceeding by Zoom today. It's important that you be mindful of the time on the clock. Counsel for relators, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal should you choose to use it. It's important you both state your name and identify the parties you represent, because we are maintaining an audio recording of this hearing, but that is the only recording permitted. Recording of this Zoom session is not allowed. So with that, counsel for relators, Mr. Ella, you may proceed.
Thank you, your honors. May it please the court. My name is Vijan Ella, represent Relators Smart Choice Healthcare Corporation and Farah Jama Mohammed. I want to zero in on a statutory issue where I think my clients and the administrative law judge divert from the Department of Human Services. And that's the department's position, as stated in its findings, that it is not necessary to prove the rule's broad definition of abuse. That's on page 9 of the addendum, and that's the department's findings as corrected or amended after the ALJ's findings. And so if I can explain, the department relies on Rule 25-6B-064, which says that the department may recover money. The department says it must, but I think that is absolutely incorrect. It may recover money that was improperly paid based on fraud, theft, or abuse in connection with the provision of medical care. And so then we go to the definition of abuse. And I'm sorry, that was Minnesota Statute 256B. Now we look at the rule defining abuse. And this is, I think, very important, your honors. It starts out with a two-part definition, and then it goes on to provide examples, and I'll address that. But it says abuse is a pattern of practices that are inconsistent with sound fiscal, business, or health service practices, and that result in unnecessary costs to the programs or reimbursement for services not medically necessary, or that fail to meet professionally recognized standards for health services. That's Rule 9505.2165, subpart 2A. We've got a few rules in this case. So then the rule goes on to provide examples. And I will concede that it doesn't say these are examples. It says the following are deemed to be abuse. But I think that the question here is, does the department need to look at the examples in the definition through the lens of the general definition? And I say, yes, it should, because just deeming examples doesn't give context for whether they rise to the level of abuse. But the department...
They're not deeming these to be examples. They are deeming these to meet the definition of abuse. That's how I read the rule. Tell me why. I mean...
Right. But if you say that an example is failure to maintain proper records, that could be a very de minimis, as in this case, that could be a very de minimis thing. And to understand whether that, or to determine whether that rises to the level of abuse, I think the department must at least make a finding that it, under this, under
so
the
what it Mr. Ella, let me before you get to that point, because that's really an argument that the legislation should be changed in some form to distinguish more clearly de minimis conduct versus something more serious, right? So, before we get to that point, I guess the threshold question for me is: are you arguing that the statute's ambiguous, or that it unambiguously requires each of the, as you call them, examples to meet the two-part, I'll call it a two-part definition, but understanding that part two has an A or B, right? It's one and two
Yep.
A or B. So are you saying that it's unambiguously requiring each of those, as you say, examples to also meet the two-part definition?
Yes.
Or are you saying it's ambiguous because when you read that first part, it sets out these two factors, and then you read the others, and these are examples, and it's not clear if the second part of the abuse definition is required in addition to? So which is it? Are you saying it's ambiguous or unambiguous?
Your Honor, I think it's unambiguous, and that means you do not have to give deference to the agency. And I think that the...
Well, it also means that we would basically disregard the policy argument you're making about whether conduct is de minimis or not. If it's unambiguous, we're just applying the unambiguous language here. If it's ambiguous, potentially then one of the canons of construction would come into play, and we would look at absurd results, or we would look at some of these policy arguments that you might be making, right? But that's only if we conclude it's ambiguous, and you're not arguing that.
Well, I think the canons of construction come into play even with an unambiguous statute. In one of the canons, or common sense, is you look at the whole statute. You don't just jump over. It says here's the definition, and the department wants to jump over the definition and go to what I think are examples of deemed abuse. And sure, it says deemed, but what does that mean? What is the definition of abuse? And they completely sidestep that and claim that they don't have to show that. And I want to just emphasize to the court, the ALJ made a finding that it did not fail to meet professionally recognized standards for health services. And the department in its final finding didn't conclude that there was a failure to meet recognized standards. It simply struck that out and said it didn't need to prove that definition. And it cited to the first, the One Best Care case, which I don't think said that at all. The One Best Care case said that the facts of that case, which it also involved time records, that there the failure to have care plans met the broad definition of abuse as a pattern of practices that are inconsistent with sound fiscal business or health services practices. So the authority that the department cites is incorrect.
Mr. Ehrlich, as we're talking about construction here, I wanted to step a little bit at a higher level and ask you how we look at the interplay of the statute. You referenced some inconsistencies, and I don't think that's disputed when you have language like may in a statute and shall in a rule. On its face, that would be inconsistent. And obviously, a rule always comes after a statute that authorizes some action. So the timing construction, if we were to apply it, doesn't seem to be relevant in terms of a... So I'm trying to understand your position as how we interpret this rule and its language and its 22 deemed violations with language in the statute that, for instance, 2F makes reference to a finable situation if you just simply don't have the necessary paperwork, which essentially is the case we have here, the case plan, if I understand correctly.
Absolutely.
And so how do we, what relevance should I ask, or what principle do we apply when we look at all these different statutory bases that seem, at least not on all four squares, consistent with the language we read in this definition of abuse and perhaps its purpose, but we still have it. So that's why we're talking about it. But do we ignore the statutes? Do we ignore the rule? Do we try to marry them? Is that what we're supposed to do under our typical statutory construction, even though they're dealing with a rule and statute? Can you give us
obviously the statutes take precedent or trump the rules here, and there are limits on the scope of the agency.
Now, why is that obvious, Mr. Ello? That's what I'm asking. Why is that obvious?
Well, I believe that's a well-accepted point of law, that the statutes, if there's a discrepancy between the rules and the statute, that the statute would prevail. And to the extent there's a discrepancy, I think that the legislature... And I think that there is, I think there is an element of the legislative purpose here in the concept that repayment is obviously appropriate in situations of fraud or where medical services were provided but weren't medically necessary. And there's a catch-all for cases of abuse, but the abuse doesn't mean any noncompliance with medical record keeping. Abuse has to be something significant. And so for the department to say that they must recover the payments and that they don't have to even make a finding that there was abuse, but just jump to the definition and then the example and say that that's medical records, which then leads to another definition of plan of care, which is different than care plan, is a stretch. I mean, the department has been increasingly over-aggressive in its application of the of its ability in general to recover payments and ignoring the clearly appropriate fine provision.
Can I ask you, and I think you're heading this direction, Mr. Ella, assume that we agree with the commissioner, or the argument that this, that the failure to comply with the requirements for care plans is deemed abuse. So we get past the abuse finding. What is your strongest argument that that the decision to require repayment in excess of $400,000 is violative of the law or otherwise arbitrary and capricious?
Well, first I would say, I think it all goes through the funnel of the definition of abuse, but you're asking me to assume that. But there is a secondary point, which is when you go down the rabbit hole, you come up with a difference between plan of care and care plan. And the ALJ correctly made that distinction in her findings and distinguished the one best care decision. So you don't actually get there even going through all the rules definitionally. And I don't think it is deemed on that secondary basis. But if you assume that, as the department would ask you to, that failure to have perfect care plans equals abuse, equals the power to recover payments, I would say that it's an abuse of discretion as set forth by the ALJ, because there's a clearly more appropriate rule that allows them to issue a fine. And I'm sorry, statute, as Judge Sleater indicated, it is a statute that says the commissioner may assess fines if specific components of documentation are missing. And we quote an attorney or an ALJ decision in our reply brief that in a similar case, this is precisely the type of incomplete documentation that is addressed by a fine authorized by Minnesota statute, 256B2F. So I guess if you don't find the statute to be unambiguous, as I would suggest, that they must at least make a finding under the broad definition of abuse and cannot skip over it, that it is an abuse of discretion under the facts.
Mr. Ella, to follow up Judge Bjorkman's question, are you suggesting, and maybe that's what your basis that the ALJ essentially did, is that because the statute uses the permissive language may obtain monetary recovery if abuse is found, and if abuse is deemed to have occurred by missing documents, is your point being that they're, unlike what the commissioner argues, it's not obligated because the statute would trump the rule because the rule was authorized by the statute and it misreads the statute and says must, that your point being that the sort of evaluation the ALJ did and the commissioner didn't, the first was not arbitrary or capricious, but the second is because it's will versus judgment?
I would agree with that, I think, Your Honor. You know, the overall,
I didn't mean to put words in your mouth, but I was trying to track what you were in answering Judge Bjorkman's question. Is that essentially the route you get to error having occurred?
Yes. I do think it's inappropriate for the department, I don't mean to pound on this, to just jump over the definition of abuse and go to the deemed example without, because the overall purpose of the statute, I think, from the legislature is clear. If there's fraud, repayment, yes. If there's unnecessary medical services, yes. And in some cases, some egregious cases, I suppose, yes, failure to keep medical records, if it rises to the level of improper care, could also result in repayment. But the department's position here would allow it to recover payments in any de minimis case of any medical record that's missing any information, when there's a clearly more appropriate statutory provision for exactly that type of situation that the legislature has included, and it has meaning and it can't be disregarded.
What role does Rule 9505.2215, which requires the commissioner to seek monetary recovery if there has been abuse by a vendor? What is the significance of that rule?
Give me the rule again. 9505.2215
subpart 1A, I think. Quote, the commissioner shall seek monetary recovery from a vendor if a payment, blah, 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 was the result of fraud, theft, abuse, or error. And it has that shall in there.
That there's no abuse. That you have to establish the elements of abuse. And they've not only failed to do it, they failed to even make a conclusion, and they claim that they don't have to even discuss that element of their own rule.
So then it seems to me that your discussion with Judge Slater kind of collapses back into, is it abuse or not? Is that fair?
Well, possibly. I don't have the rule that you're looking at, but I think Judge Slater's point is, if you look at the legislators, what the legislature has said in the statutes, there's a clear distinction here, and what the department is doing under its own rules is sidestepping the clearly more appropriate remedy of a fine and just saying that any noncompliance is going to be repayment and we don't have to follow our own rules or look at our own definitions.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Eller. Your time has expired. You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Counsel for respondent, Mr. Dietrich, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. My name is R.J. Dietrich. I'm an assistant attorney general and I represent the respondent, Department of Human Services, in this matter. Now, Your Honor, it's undisputed here that Relator Smart Choice failed to maintain statutory compliant care plans. And under the clear definition in the rule, the failure to maintain care plans constitutes abuse. And under the statute, the department is able to recover an overpayment and potentially also seek a sanction when a vendor of medical care's conduct constitutes abuse. Accordingly, for those reasons, I'm going to ask that you affirm the overpayment today.
Mr. Dietrich,
well. Thank you.
Perhaps we can start where the discussion left off with Mr. Ella and this notion that there are potentially two different remedies, and one may be more appropriate to a certain kind of conduct than the other. And I guess the bigger picture question, I realize it's not in the record, but wondering if you could give some insight. Has there been a change, as Mr. Ella argues, to how DHS is proceeding? In other words, are they is it more frequent they're seeking to recover overpayments as opposed to seeking just the fine? Or has it always been, those two avenues have always been there and have been used in the same way that they're being used today?
Your Honor, I must admit I'm not entirely, sure of the history of how DHS has always pursued these cases in the past. But certainly the statute allows, and I think DHS has the authority, obviously, to pursue an overpayment when the vendor was improperly paid as a result of abuse, as happened in this case. I guess the difference between that and a sanction is a sanction doesn't necessarily require improper payment. The way that the program is set up is that the vendor is paid and then CSRS is required by federal regulation and state regulation to conduct a post-payment review. And so it makes sense, as the statute says, that if that post-payment review determines that the vendor was improperly paid as a result of abuse or another reason, then the department can recover the amount that was improperly paid. And if the department determines that it's appropriate, the department could instead or in addition impose a sanction.
Here's my concern, Mr. Dietrich.
Yes, Your Honor.
Assuming that I agree with your argument that under the definition of abuse, the fact that the conduct here, the failure to maintain the care plans as required by the rule and as required, frankly, by the stipulation, that does constitute abuse. I mean, that's one of 22 enumerated examples, if you will, of things that are deemed to be abuse. But boy, do those 22 things cover a wide range in terms of, you know, payments for services that aren't necessary, payments for service that are duplicative. I mean, clear examples of somebody overreaching and being paid for services that weren't provided or being paid multiple times. This is a record-keeping problem. And it seems to me that there is something to the notion that the commissioner ought to be, you know, fashioning a sanction that is more commensurate with the harm. Can you help me out with how the harm here is it relates to the overpayment and suspension sanctions?
Well, Your Honor, as I mentioned before, because Relator was improperly paid as a result of the abuse here, The care plans, and I would say that this is not just a technical violation. I mean, the care plans here were missing nearly all of the requirements of the statute, 256B.0659, subdivision 7.
Mr. Dietrich, I was hoping you'd more directly answer Judge Bjorkman's question, because there's no dispute that the services were provided as required and there was no harm to the patients. And so I know the ALJ took that into account and the commissioner didn't, but what you're diving into is the legal definition. And we understand that everybody's talking about abuse today. Before you walk into this case, we might be thinking of abuse as a patient abused, but you're talking by a definition of lacking a care plan, which the ALJ found that the information was available. But my point, as I understood the question of Judge Bjorkman, I was hoping you'd answer that. Isn't there some analysis that would require a commensurate analysis? So that when it's a paperwork deficiency, which we will presume through a suspension and fine, we'll get fixed ASAP, so it won't happen mm-hmm. again, versus someone who's providing medical services not required or overcharging. I mean, they seem like a whole different bailiwick for which nobody would be disputing. Would you acknowledge that distinction and explain to us how that analysis the commissioner should be, why the commissioner should not have to use that sort of an analysis?
Yeah, I guess what I was getting to is the fact that there weren't statutory compliant care plans means the services were not reimbursable. And that's indicated both in 9505.2175 as well as 9505.0335 subpart 2D. And so it makes sense that if the services are not reimbursable, the commissioner has to have the authority to go ahead and recover an overpayment.
So what's
those
the
services
harm, though?
That were not reimbursable?
What's the harm if those services were provided?
Your Honor, the harm is, first of all, there's a difference between a sanction and an overpayment, and the statute doesn't require the department to find any sort of harm for an overpayment, certainly. But here in the commissioner's analysis, it did outline potential harm. Now, admittedly, we don't have specific evidence that any recipient was actually harmed, but there is at least the potential for harm there because, for example, these care plans were not signed by the qualified professional or the recipient as required by the legislature in the statute.
And the point, Mr. Dietrich, that the ALJ did is the potential is always has to be measured by the reality of it happening. And so that's why the ALJ looked into alternative access to the information and et cetera. And it sounds like Appellant is a fairly large company, so I assume had a number of patients, and this was, I assume, although a second time. So, but isn't that still the point, though, that it just sounds overly rigid to say you don't have it, and bam, we will interpret that as an overpayment?
Your Honor, I would say because the care plans were not statutory compliant, the services weren't reimbursable. And so that allows the commissioner to seek an overpayment.
Is the concern here perhaps that the commissioner doesn't get reimbursed from the federal government because that they require those regulations, and so then it becomes a budgetary working backwards kind of issue? In other words, if our commissioner pays to Mr. Ella's client, and then an audit's done by the government that you didn't have care plans there, and so then the state doesn't get reimbursed?
Your Honor, that is certainly possible. I must admit, I don't know in this case precisely whether or not that would be the case, but certainly federal regulations require the department to do post-payment reviews like this and to at least collect the federal share, I believe, of potential overpayments. But I must admit, I don't know necessarily if that's applicable here.
We're still struggling with and hoping you can tell us what the harm is to providing services that are not reimbursable. Perhaps there's a harm to the taxpayer, ultimately, or perhaps there's some harm to an intermediary. Or that's, I think, the heart of the question. And it doesn't sound like you've really answered if there is any harm or not. There doesn't seem to be harm to the patient if the services were provided. So what would the harm be?
Sorry, I was getting to that point. There is potential harm here. And like I said, the care plans, none of them were signed by the recipients or the qualified professional, who's the person who actually has the qualifications to create these care plans. And the qualified professional is required by statute to consult with the recipient or responsible party in creating those care plans. And so the fact that these care plans were not signed by the qualified professional and the recipient, it indicates that, you know, it's not clear that they were properly created and that they did.
Mr. Dietrich, isn't there some ability of the commissioner via the employees to say they're not signed, sign them? We see that the services are provided, and that might take a 7-day period, and it would long have occurred.
Your Honor, again, I would say that the services are not reimbursable, and so it makes sense that the commissioner can go out and recover here.
Can I ask you this? You say they're not reimbursable. Can you point me to the rule or the statute that says, under these circumstances where they are found to be not reimbursable, that the commissioner must, in fact, claw back, if you will, all of the money that had been paid for those services? Is there a rule or a statute that requires that be done in full?
No, Your Honor. And I admit that I don't believe that the commissioner is required to recover an overpayment.
And so that gets me back to my other question. I mean, I'm, you know, it's interesting to me that it looks like there's more than one ALJ that has sort of agreed with the relator's position that that when you have sort of a technical paperwork sort of violation, rather than a case mm-hmm. where services have been charged that were never provided or substandard care provided, those kinds of things that I would deem more serious, that the commissioner is exercising its will and not its judgment when it just tries to requires reimbursement in full for those services. Can you help me out with that?
Your Honor, I just would say again that the way the legislature laid things out, the legislature allowed the department to recover an overpayment when, as a result of abuse or another ground specified in the statute, the vendor was improperly paid. And that's what happened here. And that makes sense, because if they're improperly paid, the commissioner has to be able to recover the amount that they were improperly paid.
Mr. Dietrich, would it be safe to say one way the legislature spoke is by giving discretion, the commissioner may? It doesn't get to the heart, both of the conflict with the rule, but with this concept we're talking about, because the legislature didn't write shall, that the through the administrative law process, the rule regulation now does, but the legislature said may.
Yes, Your Honor, and I agree that the department is not required to recover the overpayment here, and I would construe.
But I thought your argument in your brief was different, and the commissioner's ruling seemed to suggest there was no discretion, and actually cited, I think, the rule we talked about before, the 2215, that we shall. And so,
I didn't argue in the brief that the commissioner was required to recover the overpayment, but you're right that the commissioner's order does say that the commissioner is required to recover the overpayment. And I don't believe that's correct, given the language in the statute is permissive. But here, the recovery of the overpayment was still clearly allowed. And so this court should affirm on that basis. And if this court believes that that requires a remand, then I would ask that the court remand to the commissioner instead of just reversing, to allow the commissioner to determine whether an overpayment is appropriate, given that the commissioner has discretion to recover one.
Is there any definition of the phrase monetary recovery? So I'm looking at that rule again, not the statute, but the rule that says shall seek monetary recovery. Any definition of that, or are we left to give meaning to that phrase?
Your Honor, I must admit, I'm not positive whether there's a definition of that in the rules or not. But I think...
Well, is your position that shall seek monetary recovery under the rule requires the full amount of an overpayment as opposed to something less than that? The full recovery as opposed to just any recovery?
No, Your Honor. Again, as I indicated, I don't believe the commissioner is required to recover...
But you indicated you don't think they're required to under the statute. I'm just saying, let's assume that the rule has to be followed. It says shall. And so then the question becomes, does monetary recovery mean full recovery or partial? And what is your position, assuming that we have to follow that rule or the commissioner has to follow that rule? What is your position as to whether or not that allows for partial as opposed to full recovery?
Yeah, I think what that rule is getting at is not that the commissioner has to seek recovery, but that the commissioner, if it's going to seek recovery, has to seek recovery from a vendor in that situation or from a recipient in the other situation. But certainly here, the commissioner had the discretion and appropriately did seek recovery of the overpayment. And also, because there was abuse here, appropriately suspended Smart Choice for 1 year. And I see that I'm out of time, so I would just ask that the court affirm the overpayment and the 1 year suspension of Smart Choice.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Ella, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. I want to focus in on this rule 9505. 2215, I wasn't prepared for your questions before, and I think I understand what's going on. And I would agree that there is a potential conflict between the statute, which says may, and the rule, which says shall. And to the extent that the commissioner or the department is engaged in rulemaking that changes it may to a shall, I would say that's potentially improper rulemaking, and it exceeds the scope of the legislation. The judges have suggested that maybe there's a different interpretation, maybe a recovery, maybe that's a fine. I don't know. I think the same terminology is used in the statute, but I think we have to look at the statute, not the rule.
Mr. Ella, in answering that question, and I appreciate your comment with regard to that, would it be appropriate if in an unambiguous statute, unambiguous rule, and both parties seem to concede that, and at times we do apply our egg construction canon that would suggest you read them harmoniously. Is that one method of reading all these three provisions harmoniously? Meaning if, as you argue, In the definition of abuse, there's the two-part test done. Then it takes it, then you read into the shall, because it's abuse that satisfied that two-part test. You believe then those two rules and the statute that otherwise says may, but the may has been answered by the shall because there's been the two-part test. Is that a method of analyzing these two rules and statute together harmoniously to reach a proper result?
Boy, I'm not prepared to concede that because I'm not sure I tracked it fully, but I do think that they are in conflict. I do think the statute may trumps the shall of the rule. And if what you're suggesting is that the department needs to look at the broad definition before it gets to the shall and the rule, then I would say yes, because I think it's just simply improper to skip over the broad definition as it claims it has the right to do and just ignore that entirely. I would just say before my time's up that there is the issue of the suspension. The department has conceded that the suspension of Mr. Muhammad was improper. So I just ask that the court reflect that in its order, and that we would argue that the suspension of Smart Choice was an abuse of discretion for the reasons set forth by the ALJ, and just conclude that as Your Honor saw in our reply brief, the ALJs who are close to this have repeatedly kind of found that where there's a paperwork error, but the services were actually provided and medically necessary, that the fine is the appropriate remedy and not repayment. But I think that the department has been overly aggressive here in just assuming or taking the position that it doesn't have to ever look at its own definition of abuse, which is part one and two AB, is one of the judges suggested. I think ignoring its own rule in that way is just simply improper. And it does need to make a finding as to whether, because I think it all, you know, to your point of making this all harmonious, I think that the improper paperwork is deemed to be an example, but it has to, but the context of the rule itself, it's not even multiple rules, is that it has to, the paperwork issue has to rise to a level that's just professionally, which is a failure to meet professionally recognized standards. So if a health care provider had no medical records whatsoever, then yeah, it could be abuse. This is ridiculous. You have absolutely no records. But if you have an imperfection.
Isn't there a specification of what the standards are? And that includes case plans and signed case plans and all of the requirements that aren't met here or that were the subject of the stipulation?
Of course, there's extremely detailed requirements, all kinds of very detailed requirements. And if you look at all of them, I'd say we probably had 99% compliance. But you have a specific rule that says that if there's incomplete paperwork, a fine is appropriate. And there's a Canada construction that says that if, and I can't remember now if that's a rule or a statute, but that says that, you know, it has to have meaning. And in the way that the department's interpreting this, it doesn't have meaning. They would just always go for repayment.
I know your time's dwindling, but I wanted to circle back to something Judge Bjorkman mentioned previously. Let's assume that the stipulation in this case says shall seek a full recovery or shall seek overpayment, recovery of all overpayments. Can parties agree in that stipulation to bind the commissioner's remedy here, requiring the commissioner to seek the full amount? I'm not saying, does the stipulation say it? I'm saying, can parties generally, can they agree to something that would then bind the commissioner to seek the full amount?
Well, I looked at this issue, Your Honor, and as a starting point, the if you're talking about the stipulated provider agreement, it says that if we fail to meet the terms and conditions, DHS will suspend. But it doesn't say anything specifically about recovering payments. So I don't think, even if this is a contract or a quasi-contract or anything, you know, similar, there was no agreement to this repayment. It just says other appropriate actions. So we just end up back where, you know, we're looking at what are the powers of the department and the rules and the statutes. But I agree. I just have zero time left. I would just say I agree with the ALJ's analysis of this as, not a bargain for situation, but an imposition by the department, and leave it at that. So we would ask that you reverse the department, and thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Ella. Thank you, Mr. Dietrich. The case was well presented. We really appreciate your thoughtful arguments this morning.